That's session number 33503, reel 1.
It's something that happened to me during the war, and I think I'll just call it the time I was nearly repatriated. Now, for those not quite with it, I'd better explain about this repatriation. It simply means being sent home. Like when you're a prisoner of war and cut off from everyone you know, the future's uncertain, and then suddenly they tell you you're going home. You can imagine the feeling. I suppose it's the nearest thing in Civvy Street is being told that you won the pools. Anyway, in about 1943, early in 1943, I was an inmate of a prisoner of war camp called Sulmona. That's about 150 miles south of Rome. There are about 3,000 of us in the camp. English, Scotch, Welsh, Jewish. There were even a couple of Irishmen there. Apparently they put their names down for it. They thought it was run by Pontins. We were housed in huts, about 80 to a hut, and we slept in two-tier bunks. It wasn't a very big camp, a little larger than the school playground, and the huts were close together. The camp was surrounded by a high wall, on the other side of the wall, bags of barbed wire, and every few yards, high observation posts manned by machine gun happy eye ties, with their searchlights and all the rest of it. I'd been in the camp for about 2 years. I was almost a founder member. From time to time, fresh prisoners came in. Even air crew shot down over Italy. And it was funny to talk to somebody who only 2 days previously had been drinking beer in an English pub. But at least this way we managed to keep up with the latest war news. I'm telling you all this because it's got nothing to do with the particular story, but at least it puts you in the picture. And while I'm about it, I think I'd better fill you in with the state of the war at that time. I think it will help you to understand the story better. D-Day hadn't started, and the main battleground had been in North Africa. A year previously, the Germans and Itais under Rommel had pushed us back right across North Africa. They almost reached Egypt. If they did that, they would have captured the Suez Canal and it would have been almost all over in their favour. But at last we got our fingers out. Wavell was made supreme commander. And thousands upon thousands of men and tanks and planes were poured into Egypt. And just when Rommel thought he was going to have his first night's kip in Cairo, we opened up. We threw everything at them and they just crumbled. It didn't happen overnight, but within a very few months, Rommel was pushed right back across North Africa to Tripoli. Many of the Germans managed to scramble on boats and back across the Med to southern Italy, the rest either captured or killed. But the Allies' offensive went on, and eventually they invaded southern Italy. As before, this was done on a huge scale, and the new battleground was Italy, as the American and British troops fought for every inch of ground. It was a real bloody war at this stage, and the Germans knew they had to hold on, and they did. Allies' advance was halted, and the position was almost stalemate, just men getting killed. And this is the time of my story, remember, 1943, and I'm in a camp at Sulmona. It was one afternoon, pretty cold outside, and we were all in our huts doing the usual things, like writing home, reading, playing cards, or in my case, just kipping. The door opened, and in came Jack Drew. He looked more Itai than the Itais themselves. He had jet black hair with a bushy beard. And in Civvy Street, I believe he was a clerk of some sort. And the ITIs had given him a job in their quarters, either sweeping the offices or licking stamps or something like that. Anyway, he came in. And above the din, he shouted out, "I don't know whether anybody's interested, but all tradesmen are going to be repatriated." Well, everything went quiet for a minute, and then all of a sudden, everything broke loose. The next 5 minutes, it was a bit noisy. Old Joe was still standing by the door, and I can remember him getting hit by a boot round the ear hole. He seemed to lose all interest. Went across to his bunk and lay down. Anyway, after a time, things quieted down. And about a couple of hours later, me and another bloke walked across to Joe and gave him a prod. He sat up, and the first words he said, "Who the blankety blank threw that bloody boot? It's flicking well nearly killed me." Anyway, we pacified him and said we thought we won the ITIs through a boot for the window, but it didn't pacify him very much. But anyway, we said to him, "Look, what's this about the rumour, Joe? What's all this about tradesmen being repatriated?" He said, "Well," he said, "one of the ITIs told me." He said, "I think there's something in it." Anyway, you can imagine that within half an hour it got round the camp and everybody was talking about this latest bit of rumour mongering. But it went on, and the next couple of days the rumour still grew, and chaps that went out into the ITIs department working came back with the same story. They'd asked ITIs out there, and none of them actually said they knew nothing about it, but they just wouldn't confirm it. Anyway, a few days later, on the order board of the day, came a notice. And it said, in effect, "Well, all tradesmen in Civvy Street, give their names to the sergeant as a list is being made out." It also said, if you weren't a tradesman, like a plumber or an engineer or electrician, don't bother, as they had their own records. And anybody trying to get on the list, if they weren't a tradesman, would just be scrubbed off. Well, you can imagine that every bloke thought, right, this is it. Those are electricians, plumbers and that, they're going home. And I was among the first. I gave my name in, and I think it was about 300 of us in all. And we heard nothing for about a week. And about a week later, another notice on the board. "For the following men, report at 9 o'clock on a certain morning, be kitted out with battle dress." Well, this was it. You know, this sounded very good. And duly we reported that the aforesaid time, they marched us out to the Italians' quarters, and there, in a big hut, we were all issued with brand new battle dress, as supplied by the Red Cross. They used to send out bales of clothing, you know, for when our own clothing wore out. We all got brand new back dress each, even to hat. We looked very smart. And they told us, the ITIs told us not to wear the clothing, just to keep it by until we were told to put it on. So we went back. Well, we were almost heroes, us 300 blokes. The other chaps started deciding where their parents and girlfriends lived, and we were all getting notices and all getting addresses to go and see, and you know, people like that. Eventually, about a week later, we was these 300 men were told to report at 9 o'clock the following morning with full battle dress and all our belongings. And this appeared to be the crunch. We were so excited, we'd rather get dressed anyway. I know, on this particular morning we got ready, went down to the gate, the Italian guards came in, and they marched us off. Everybody cheering and shouting and hollering. all clutching our bits of paper and our addresses and our little bits and pieces. And off we went right through the village, and all the villagers came out watching us go, wondering what was happening, thought the war was over, as we did almost. And we went and we marched to the station. The train came in. We were all put in the train, about the small carriage, about 9 or 10 to a carriage, and a guard to each carriage. And then the train set off. Well, it stopped several times during the day, and we got some rations, you know, sandwiches, things like that, during the day. And the windows were covered up, so we couldn't see what was happening. And sometime early in the evening, we arrived at what we thought was Rome. We could hear the hustle and bustle of the people outside, and the guard who was sitting with us, he was an old boy, about 60, he said it was Rome, Central Rome Station. And we thought, well, this appears we're going up through the northern part of Italy, across into Spain, which was a neutral country. And the train set off from the station, and a little bit later we came to what we thought was a siding or something like that. The train stopped, and we were there for a couple of 3 hours. We mostly went to kid, you know, we were sleeping, dreaming of getting home and all this. And after about 2 hours, the train started on. Travelled on for hours upon hours. We couldn't see much. The guard wouldn't let us look through the windows, but we had a rough idea. Seemed to be getting colder anyway. And early in the morning, it must have been about 6 o'clock. One of the chaps happened to peek through, pull the curtain aside, and look through. And we all had a glance. The guard, by this time, didn't seem to bother. And we were going right across what we thought was the Alps itself. We're looking, it was all snow covered, it was a magnificent sight. And the train was just chugging along on this, almost seemed to be suspended in heaven. And looking miles below was the snow and the mountains and everything. It is a grand sight. And we thought, well, this is it, we'll shortly be free. You know, we had visions of being shortly in Spain, and this is it. The guard said, put the curtain back. We were so excited, we started titillating ourselves, you know, for what's it going to be like when we reach Spain, you know, be a bit warmer, people would cheer perhaps, I don't know. And the train went on. Eventually, it was pretty early in the morning, it must have been about 8 o'clock I suppose, the train stopped. And there was a hell of a lot of shouting, hollering, orders being given, and we thought, well, this must be the frontier, we're being handed over. And we just couldn't understand what was going on. The guard stood up and made sure that nobody opened the curtains, and it was like this for about half an hour, with all the time shouting and hollering outside. Suddenly the doors were flung open, and a voice shouted, "Rouse! Rouse!" We couldn't quite cotton on at first. We thought, what's this? I looked outside, and there were German guards, German SS men, young men with rifles with bayonets attached. "Out! Rouse!" And because we poured out the carriage onto the side of the track, we looked up and I saw the name of the station. It was called Brenner. This was the famous Brenner Pass, and the station was Brenner Station. It seemed to hit us suddenly. At first it was hard to understand, but we were suddenly realising what was happening. And we were lined up along the side of the track. There were hundreds of German guards. The eye ties almost disappeared at the side. They were of no consequence. And one or two chaps that weren't very quick were slashed across the back with a rifle butt, and we knew these blokes were professionals. There was no messing around. We We stood up straight as we could in one long line. A German commander came out, called out our names. As our names were called, we had to hold our hand out. After that, they counted us. Our spirits went bang like that. We'd been a prisoner of war for 2 years, and now we landed with this. It was obvious what was happening. We were going to Germany. Anyway, after we were counted, we were all pushed back in the train. This time, no guards, but each door was jammed tight, locked from the outside. No chance of opening. The windows were jammed tight. The windows couldn't open anyway. And after half an hour or so, all the guards poured into one of the carriages, to the carriages, and the train set off. We just looked at each other. One or two blokes almost broke down. You know, we couldn't quite grasp what it meant. But anyway, the train went on. We obviously German territory by now. We left the Alps long behind. And the train went on through the morning, and about midday, we stopped. Innsbruck, in Austria. The doors were opened, and the guards were shouted. They did more hollering than anything. They just shouted. They prodded us with their bayonets. And they hit one or two butts across the back with the rifle butts just to get us moving. And we were poured out onto the station. Lined up as usual. And they gave us little cups of soup. That was the first food we'd had for about 18 hours. It was just like water, but anyway, it went down well. After that, we were put back into the train, and the train sped on through Austria into Germany. Sometime in the afternoon, the train stopped. There was no station there, just railway and some sidings. There were guards everywhere, German guards everywhere. Out from the train, one or two prods with the bayonets and shouting and hollering in German. We were formed up into fours and marched. So it was only about 10 minutes, and we reached the prisoner of war camp that we were going to. It was Stalagate B, Lamb's Door. We found it after one of the biggest prisoner of war camps in Germany. After the one we left in Sulmona, there was no comparison. This place was just like a small town. You walk through the huge gates and through the German quarters. We eventually handed in through the several strands of barbed wire, through gates, guards, searchlights, dogs, everything. We eventually moved in to the actual prisoner of war section. This was Lambsdorff, Stalagate B. And this was the start of another 2 years of prisoner of warship. During the next couple of weeks, we often wondered what happened to our pals back in Sulmona. And it's a marvellous system, this, you know. You get prisoner of war, you get bits of information, blokes coming in, going from one camp to another. Sometimes bits read in the newspaper, but it's surprising how the news travels, and it travels all over the place. And some weeks afterwards, we managed to piece together what happened after we left. Well, apparently, a few weeks after we left Sulmona, the Italians capitulated. In other words, they packed it in. But the Germans were still in Italy, and the war more or less continued while the Germans were trying to hold on. And what we can hear of it, it was a real bloody war. In fact, the famous Battle of Cassino, Mount Cassino, took place. and that was a massacre. The casino wasn't very far from Solmona. But, as I said before, the Italians backed in, they lost all interest. The Germans had almost took them prisoners in their efforts to try and hold on to Italy. They didn't want to be pushed back into Austria. But the Allies advanced slowly and surely, and we gathered that the prisoner of war camp gates were thrown open. Blokes were told, every man for himself. And this is a tragedy. A lot of our friends were killed, we heard after. Blokes we knew by name, yeah, they were killed by guards, killed by Germans. Most of them fled into the mountains. The idea was, I suppose, that when the Allies advanced, they'd go into the Allies' lines and report they were ex-prisoners of war. But it didn't work quite like that. As I say, the war was bloody. It was fighting everywhere. Every little village was fought for. Tanks, guns, planes and everything. Some blokes managed to get away. We heard one or two names of fellas that got back into the Allies' lines and eventually got back home. A lot of blokes died. A lot of blokes we knew. Our camp, Solmona camp, the camp we knew for 2 years, was heavily bombed. And that's it. And the war went on. Stalag 8B was a real eye-opener. After being in the little prison of war camp in Solmona, this place was magnificent. There must have been at least 40,000 men there. It was huge, huge place. A lot of the prisoners were from Dunkirk, and chiefly it was what they call a base camp. Prisoners went there, and from there they went out into working camps, small working camps where they had to work. But here, they didn't, you know. Sergeants and above never had to work in Germany unless they took charge of a working party. But all ranks below that of sergeant spent very few days here, and they went out to working camps where they had to work hard. But Stalag 8B itself was, as I said before, it was like a small town. There were football teams and bands, dance bands, military bands. Most of the stuff was sent out by the Red Cross. You've got to remember that a lot of these fellows have been there for about 2 or 3 years. From the early days of the war, 1940, at Dunkirk, they were captured, a lot of them. And during that time, the camp had grown, got bigger. The Red Cross had poured stuff in, and the Germans had no objection to that. Even musical instruments came in. When the men found that they were being killed by boredom, the Red Cross did all they could. And as I said, we had military bands, we had dance bands. There was always something happening at night time. There was concerts going on. It wasn't quite like a holiday camp. I mean, after all, we were prisoners of war, you know. But it was a lot better than Solmona in many ways, although the Germans were different people altogether to deal with. Most of the prisoners managed to keep away from the Germans. If you were inside the compound, you had very little contact with the Germans, but us blokes below the rank of sergeant, well, we weren't there very long. I think I spent about three weeks in Lambsdorff. And they made sure we were all right, checked us, made sure we were fit for work. About 3 weeks later, we were sent out to various working camps. I went to Auschwitz, the famous Auschwitz, where the Jewish camp was. I was next door to the Jewish camp. And I worked there for about a year. And that was quite interesting too. You know, Colin, you started something. Ask me what I had for dinner last Tuesday, I wouldn't know. But ask me to think about the war, and it all comes back in a flood of memories. So vivid, I can remember almost everything. It's marvellous how these things, after all this time, you can remember all these things. The things that happened to me. Sometimes when I look back, think about these things, I wonder, did it really happen? But it did. Because you've got to remember, when you're 30, you're a bit different man from when you're 70. And life's different. Every bit of life is an adventure. And you look on it in a different way. But anyway, I've got a fund of memories, and it is nice to think about them, you know. At least it gives you something to think about, and it's, you can say to yourself, at least I was there. And I think about the war years, and the places I've been to, and the things I've seen. It makes me think I could almost write a book, if I could write. You know, you go to see these war films, see the marvellous things that take place, you come away and you say, well, that's only fiction. But the funny thing is that truth is stranger than fiction. I know from my own experience that in wartime, anything can happen, it usually does. They say that a cat's got 9 lives. But if I'd been a cat in the war, I would have used them all up. How was I captured? How did I lose my freedom? I'm Signalman Essence, number 258-5471. Just a cog in the wheel. My trade was an instrument mechanic. I used to repair the wireless sets. Or repair at them. Usually opened up, and if a valve wasn't lighting up, you put a new valve in, it was all right. Anyway, the time is Easter. Very early on in the war, about 1940. Just before Easter, was a week before. And I was attached to Advanced Divisional Headquarters. We in the maintenance section had an Austin 3-ton truck with canvas roof. We had a workshop inside. And we were supposed to look after all the wireless sets at DivHQ. About 100 yards away from our truck was the command vehicle where the general lived. Bloody great big thing, about twice the size of a bus, armour plated throughout. Like a palace inside, armchairs, everything. That's where he lived, and we never saw much of him, he stayed there all the time. Anyway, this is a week before Easter, as I said, and the Germans started a push. So, we had to retreat. And we retreated along the coast road, there was nowhere else to go. The desert was just a desert. No identification except a few petrol tins to different base camps and things like that. But the main route was along the coast, right across North Africa. And the orders were for us to retreat. In other words, beat it. We didn't need to be told twice. And that's how it all started. We got on this coast road and I told it for Tobruk, we thought. We knew that Tobruk was the main army, all the equipment, soldiers, everybody. That's where the last stand would be if it was going to be anywhere. So we set off for Tobruk, about 400 miles to go. There were several other vehicles on the road and sometimes it was in a convoy. We just kept bashing, but anyway, after about 100 miles, as far as I can remember, the road was blocked by military police. And all vehicles were directed off of the main road to a place called Port McKeely. All orders, every vehicle to go to Port McKeely. The route was marked out by petrol tins, 4-gallon, bright tin cans that we used to put petrol in. And that was it. So we set up across the desert in our old 3-ton Austin. Just ordinary road wheels, you know, they were slipping like mad in the sand, but we gradually went on and on. And we finally arrived at this fault. Well, apparently it had been a fault in the Polynesian days. There wasn't much of it left now. No buildings, just a couple of brick ruins and a couple of old outhouses. Just nothing at all. Just a place in the desert. And when we arrived there, I suppose there were about 2,000 men. All sorts. Ragtag army. A few infantrymen, a few artillerymen, a couple of Indians. All made up this ragtag army. There were a few vehicles there. Couple of light tanks, but nothing to shout about. There was no armaments, no. The only arms there were the 303 guns that we carried. In fact, most of them were non-combatants, like first aid men and things like that, and us signalmen. There was one captain who appeared to be in command. I think he was from an infantry regiment, with a sergeant major. They had a platoon of infantrymen with them. And there was also a padre. The padre, I never forget the padre. He was, I think, as far as I can remember, he was about 65 years old, this padre. Little bloke, white collar on, with his khaki uniform. And he did great work, really, because things were a bit sticky then, and it appears to us that, well, we gathered the information that most of us have been sent there to divert the main German thrust to enable Tobruk to get ready for them. Apparently they were building up a big force at Tobruk to take on the Germans.